Well, good morning. It is good to see everyone this morning. This is one of the chapters in Mark that gets some of the most attention. I don't know if it's our fascination with the end, what the end looks like. When Jesus talks about God's judgment, how does that look like the end? How does that look like the fall of Jerusalem? And so we'll spend the next two classes. Hey, Luke, would you mind turning on the back monitor for me? Thank you. So we'll spend the next two classes working through Mark on exactly what Jesus is talking about. And this is at least will likely be one of the sections where we have the most disagreement. On what is this talking about? What does it look like? What is Jesus trying to teach? So a couple of things as we do that, and knowing that's likely, try to keep focused in the text that Jesus is talking about. Keep focused in the context. We may still come to different conclusions, but look for the evidence that's given in the context. Look for evidence given elsewhere in the Bible. So when you see a word or phrase that's used, see if you can find it elsewhere, whether that be in Old Testament prophecies or Old Testament messages God sent his prophets, because that may give us insight as we work through this. So actually, before we begin, Micah, would you mind leading us in prayer?
Our Heavenly Father, we come before you thanking you for the day that you've blessed us with and the opportunity that we can gather together and to praise your name. We're so thankful for your word, and we recognize within it we see your character and your plan for us and for all mankind, and we humbly approach it wanting to see your goodness, your beauty, and conform to be more like you. We're so thankful for the example of your son, Jesus. Help us to represent him to the world around us. Be with each and every one of us. It's in your son's name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. So we're in this section in chapter 11. We're getting to the last week of Jesus's life. He's going to become a little more pointed in his messages to his disciples. And what are some of those messages we've seen in chapters 11 and 12 that Jesus has declared or stated or taught? What are some of the main themes there? Micah?
One of the key parts would be in chapter 12, 28 and following, that says that what God has called us to is to love with our all, and that there were some people who missed that point through their questioning, through their self-justification.
Yeah, so there were people that were trying to be self-justified. What is it? What am I going to have to do to find justification so I'm going to look good? Well, and in looking good, they were actually not genuine in their heart and in their mind. They were just in it for the show. And Jesus said, they have their reward. They got the praise of men. And that's what they would get. Lisa?
Also in chapter 12, the distinction between the world and the spirit and to render to God what is his.
Yeah, so there's a contrast of images. We have the coin image when they say, is it lawful to pay taxes? Jesus says, well, whose inscription's on the coin? If you're going to operate in Caesar's realm, you're going to operate and own that whatever Caesar's, you're going to have to pay back some of that to Caesar's. But when you're operating in God's realm, our bodies, our image, we're in God's image. That's the part that's supposed to be given to God. What else?
Resurrection, to prove there wasn't a resurrection. And he just literally seated them with his comeback. So to prove that they proved to themselves that there was a resurrection.
Yeah, so the Sadducees who didn't believe in the resurrection came up and they had this wonderful hypothetical situation as they saw it. that completely disprove the resurrection. And Jesus points out, you guys don't know the scriptures or the power of God. And goes on to tell them some things about them. David?
Yeah, the scribes, the Jewish leaders, questioned his authority, asking him, you know, by what authority do you say these things? And he kind of turns it around on them and asks them a question that they're not willing to answer because, and so he's not going to answer their question either.
Yeah, so Jesus also in chapters 10, 11, 12 has really started showing that their religion as they knew was going to come to an end. The temple would be destroyed. The nation would not exist, and they are struggling with that. And they come to him and say, well, by what authority are you preaching against the temple? By what authority are you doing these things? Jesus says, well, I'm going to ask you a story too. So John the Baptist, was his baptism from heaven or from men? And it's like, they're like, well, we can't answer that. So he says, I'm not going to answer you either.
They were all trying to trip him up, and then one scribe came to him and recognized him for who he was. And he said, what is the greatest commandment? He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, told him he was closer to the kingdom than he knew. And that just put an image in my head of how many will receive God. It's always a few, maybe one. But that one is worth it.
Yeah, so in the context, you see all these people that are trying to trip Jesus. And that was at the end or middle of chapter 12, kind of verse 28 through 34. You see a scribe that comes to Jesus that it's completely different from the rest of the questions we've seen. The scribe comes up and asks Jesus, and Jesus gives him the answer. Then the scribe repeats back to Jesus and says, you know what? You have spoken well. That's ultimately what God was wanting from the people. And Jesus tells him, you are not far from the kingdom of heaven. You are not far from the kingdom of God. And so it's in that context that we get into chapter 13. Just to keep the context in front of us, we'll go on and read the whole chapter, and then we'll come back and kind of work our way through the text. Mark 13. And as he came out of the temple, one of the disciples said to him, look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings. Jesus said to him, do you see these great buildings? There will not be left one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, and John and Andrew asked him privately, tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Jesus began to say to them, see that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name saying, I am he, and they will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and there will be famines, but these are but the beginning of birth pains. But be on your guard, for they will deliver you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them. And the gospel must first be proclaimed to all nations. And when they bring you to trial and deliver you over, do not be anxious beforehand what you are to say, but whatever is given to you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. And brother will deliver brother over to death, and the father, his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to be, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the rooftop not go down nor enter his house to take anything out. And the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that it may not happen in winter. For in those days there will be such tribulation that has not been seen from the beginning of creation that God created until now and will never be. And if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened those days. And if there is anyone who says to you, look, here is the Christ, or look, there he is, do not believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will arise and perform signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But be on guard. I have told you all these things beforehand. But in those days after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will be falling from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds and from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heaven. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But concerning that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It's like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight, or when the rooster crows in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. So as we begin in chapter 13, how does this section differ from chapters 11 and 12? David?
His disciples, I mean, to the apostles, it seems like.
Yeah, it just seems like this is kind of more of a separate conversation he's having with the apostles. Tony?
I think this is addressing the literal destruction of the temple.
Yeah, so he gets a little more specific that the temple will be falling down. He's kind of spoken in parables. He's kind of given them Old Testament passages that talk about how God would judge his house because of the way they were living. But this one, he's pretty clear about it.
If I understand correctly, he was drawing near to Jerusalem and in the temple. And we are told in 13:1 that he is now out of the temple.
Yes, so you see multiple times it's mentioned. Chapter 11, verse 11, 11, verse 15, 11, verse 27, and 12, verse 35. He is in the temple. He's coming to the temple. And then we kind of see a separation from that. And so what does that picture remind you of? He's in the temple, and then now he's outside the temple. Okay, the tabernacle. Micah?
Reminds me of, I don't know the exact chapters, but in Ezekiel, chapters around 8 through 10, where Ezekiel is given this vision, this tour of the temple and all the abominations that are going on there. And you see this gradual progression of the presence of the Lord leaving the temple as a sign of judgment. And you can see that ties in with this.
Yeah, and to your point, I believe it's chapter 10. So you hit the nail right on the head. It's a picture of God, and it specifically says he goes eastward out of the temple. Do you remember where the Mount of Olives is if you're looking on a map compared to Jerusalem? It's east. So Jesus has now come out of the temple, gone to the east side, and he's beginning to tell them about what would happen to Jerusalem. It's kind of interesting. So Jesus has been telling his disciples about a lot of things, and Peter's like, look at these buildings. It's kind of interesting. In Jeremiah 7, we've mentioned Jeremiah 7 multiple times. Jeremiah 7, later in chapter 7, it specifically mentions, it's where Jesus got his quotation, my house is supposed to be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. Therefore, because you've done that, I'm going to do to this house what I did to Shiloh. When you get before that in chapter 7, God speaking to Israel, and he says, correct your ways, correct your actions, and I will allow you to live in this place. Do not trust in deceitful words chanting, this is the temple of the Lord, this is the temple of the Lord, this is the temple of the Lord. The people in Jeremiah's day were like, God's not going to destroy this because we have the temple. We see that very similar concept when they had the ark and they were losing to the Philistines. Their thought was, okay, we're losing the battle because we don't have the ark. They take the ark out into battle and lose the ark. I don't know if that's what Peter's talking about here. He's hearing about some of the things that are happening. He's like, but look at the building. Look at this building. Well, in Jeremiah, they did that. And God says, that's not what's going to save you. It's not because the temple is here. And so he says, okay, there's going to be a time where not one stone's left upon another. And the disciples ask him privately, they're like, hey, can you give us a heads up when this is going to happen? How does Jesus begin to answer the disciples' questions? So when will these things be and what will be the signs? David?
Don't be deceived or led astray, because there's going to be lots of talk that isn't true, and you're going to be told things that aren't true. Remember, you heard it from me.
There's going to be a lot of things happening. There's going to be wars. There's going to be earthquakes. There's going to be all sorts of things, and people are going to point to that and say, look, it's coming. And he says, that's not going to be the sign that this is coming. So don't be deceived. What else do you see? Craig?
I'm not sure exactly where to make this point. The irony of this entire series of questions is they're bragging on a structure that the Romans built for them. This was what Herod enhanced for them. So the structure was already there. Obviously, it had been rebuilt, right, when they came back. But Herod had enhanced. So they're bragging on something the Romans had done, this fickle nation that they actually wanted overthrown, but yet they're touting the temple as this thing that is so impressive that will withstand anything. And so Jesus's response seems to be, you know, this is not as stable as you think. And the thing that you're trusting in, as was back in Jeremiah, is something that you're trusting in the wrong thing rather than the presence of the one who lives in the temple.
And Jesus mentions that later in the chapter, verse 31, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. You see a comparison. These things that people look at and like, this will not be destroyed. Jesus is like, well, heaven and earth are going to be destroyed, but my words will be the thing that last. Micah, then Vicky.
The argument that they give is that this is God's house. God's here. But do we find anywhere in the scriptures since Ezekiel's vision of God leaving the temple, the glory of God leaving the temple, that it ever returned? No, I don't think so. So they're still, touting something that is not there. The presence of God was not there, I don't believe.
There definitely seems to be a finality to this part of what's happening. God's destroyed multiple temples, multiple dwelling places, taken his people places, brought them back, taken them, brought them back, and this seems to be more of a finality to the nation as they knew it. Vicky?
I think that this scripture reminds me of what he said in chapter 12 about the scribes. How they like to be seen, how they like the long robes. And then we've learned, too, throughout the study of Mark, that Jesus denounces people who are showy, maybe not in Mark, but throughout the Gospels. And so I think this is no different to me. The temple, yes, it was beautiful, but that's not the point.
Jesus seems to be preparing them this entire time for the fact that God no longer dwells in temples made with hands. We're told that later on. And so he's just preparing them for that, that the physical temple where the presence of God dwelt is going away, and you're going to be under a new covenant. So he's actually introducing the new covenant to them and preparing them that we will no longer, he dwells within us, no longer dwells in temples made with hands, but within each of us.
And he's about to, in one of the next couple chapters, he's about to start talking about this new covenant when he sits down and has a Passover meal with his disciples. And he said, this is the blood of the new covenant, which was shed for you. Imagine how hard that would be, though, if you were a Jew and you're hearing this. You have, not to paint too broad of a stroke, if you were a Jew, you grew up, the temple was something that was a part of your life, a centerpiece of your life, centerpiece of your religion, centerpiece of your history, and then that is going to be destroyed. Your way of life is going to change. It's not going to be about these sacrifices. It's not going to be about this, more or less, the priest and the order in which they had, or the order in which they were ordained. Imagine how hard that would be. How hard would it be if someone came in today and said, I want you to completely rearrange your worship, what day you're doing it on, the building you're doing it on. How difficult would that be for us to hear? How difficult would that be for us to just say, oh, you're absolutely right? And that's what these people are faced with. And so God is trying to show them through Jesus that there is a better covenant coming. And there's a better covenant, read Hebrews, because of who Jesus is and what he can offer the people. As the perfect lamb, there was no need for a daily sacrifice, a daily offering. There was no need for these trips to the temple. You will be the temple. He told them multiple times in the prophets, you will be the temple. Our body is a temple. This thing is changing. And that would be difficult, even for the apostles to hear. That would be difficult. And we see that continue in Acts as they're starting the early church in Acts. You see this concept of, well, you're a Gentile, so you got to be circumcised to be saved. And part of the thing is that's gone. It's not a matter of whether you're circumcised or not, whether you're free or slaved. Jesus kind of broke down all of those barriers. And it's kind of interesting as Jesus starts this, they ask, when will these things be? What will be the sign? And he kind of starts off by saying, this will not be the sign. When you hear these things, don't be distracted by them. Don't believe when people are like, oh, here it is, here it is. There was an earthquake. God's coming. This judgment's coming. He says, do not listen to that. Gary?
It's a little bit deceiving in this caption here. In Matthew 24, the question is put forth in three parts. 24:3, tell us when will these things be? One, what will be the sign of your coming to and of the end of the age? Three. So when he answers, he answers all three of those questions in 24, and he still answers all three questions in Mark here, but it makes it a little bit more confusing when only two questions are posed here.
Yeah, good point. So if you didn't hear that, so in Matthew, you kind of see three questions asked by the disciples. In Mark, you really only see two. I think Mark 13 ends up answering all three that the disciples originally had. It's just Matthew, there's a little bit more of a transition. Mark, it's maybe a little more difficult to tell where that transition is. Bob?
And really, to tie all that together, doesn't he in Matthew say, no one knows, only God the Father knows? And so the answer to the question, whether it's Matthew or Mark or wherever, is you're not going to know. You're not going to be able to predict when it's going to happen, unlike so many people over the years have tried to do. So there are going to be some things that you need to prepare for, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen then. And he talks a whole lot here about what's going to happen to you. Just stay strong through it all. Endure to the end, as it says in the last verse.
Yeah, so he tells them, watch, because there's a lot of things that are going to happen before this event happens. Keep your eyes open. You're going to be handed to councils. You're going to speak before kings. Don't give up. Endure to the end.
Yes. I think the most important thing he said is what he started with before all of these signs is many will come in my name saying, I am he, and they will lead me. So there's a lot that's going to come and tell them all of these signs are from God because they're going to claim to be God.
And a little bit of the confusing point is he says they're also going to perform signs. So these people are going to be able to do something that shows they have power, or they're going to do some, and whether that be a trick or something, but they're going to show a sign. Don't believe them. He tells them, I've told you. My words are what you need to listen to. Don't listen to someone else. So he says, okay, Mindy.
Earlier about how he actually starts out saying, this is not the sign. My podcast Bible teacher that I like to listen to said, imagine that you're giving somebody directions back when we used to do that before we used our phone. And you might be like, okay, so you're going to go down the road a ways and there's going to be like kind of a T, but make sure you don't go off on the right because that'll lead you to a dead end. So kind of stay to the left when you see the big tree, but just keep on going, you know, and you're going to pass the like, that used to be a Wendy's back in the day, but now it's a Burger King and you're going past that. And how we used to say, like, look for this, watch out for this hazard, you know, there's a pothole over here or whatever. And that was kind of part of our directions to not be led astray, just keep on going. You're going to pass all these things on your way before he finally gets to some things where he does say, like, okay, and now this is a sign, like, you're getting close.
Yeah, so in the travel, as he's telling them, don't give up. He's like, these all are things you're going to see. Lisa? No, go ahead.
Well, also in this portion, it made me think of in the banking industry, anytime a new issue of currency would be sent out, we in the bank, we would be trained on what an authentic bill looked like so that we could easily recognize counterfeits, which would be really fulsome. So Jesus in his love for us and the disciples and the apostles is being very clear and giving them a heads up and telling them to focus on the truth, the rule, the standard.
We know the little gal in Acts, she was performing signs from the spirit of divination. And so that we're going to see signs performed, but they can be performed from Satan just as well.
Yeah, there are other forces that can perform. Jesus says, keep your eyes on me. Keep your eyes on my words. Don't be distracted by it. So, catching us up, the disciples say, look at this building. Jesus says, as nice as this building is, there's not going to be one stone that's left upon another that won't be torn down. So the disciples say, well, when will these things be? What will be the sign? He says, well, do not be deceived. There's going to be people coming. They're going to be pointing to events saying, here is the sign. There is the sign. He says, don't believe them. And then Jesus gets to it in verse 14. Roy?
I don't know how relevant this is, but my Bible has a footnote where it says the sign. It says a testing miracle. What will be the attesting miracle?
Okay.
Of your coming, of these things happening.
What will be the testing miracle? Is that what it said?
A testing
miracle. Okay. Yeah, so there'll be something that points to it, and then he uses this abomination of desolation, and we think apocalypse, and we're like, what is this? So I guess what would be the warning sign? I'm going to show that. And what is the abomination of desolation? Bob?
Well, as far as a warning sign, anybody saying that they know when it's going to happen, that should be a warning that it's not going to happen then. We've seen that throughout history. The abomination, that's man being put before God in any relation or in any type.
Okay.
Would be in that. I know the Jews sometimes looked at times when the temple was entered by, I can't remember the name yet, but that was described as an abomination.
Okay.
So, you know, something like that. Well, in 70 AD, the temple's going to be destroyed. Rome's going to enter Jerusalem. Is that an abomination? It would be. How many would there be? Who knows?
Okay. Gary?
I believe that's spoken of in Daniel prophesied. I believe it's referring to when the Romans come to besiege the city, they'll be able to see that marching army coming towards them, and they won't have much time to act. That's why he's telling them, whatever you're doing, once you see them coming, you need to flee before they come and encircle the city.
Yes. So to Gary's point, in the context, go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say that one of the things we see is the ensign of the armies being posted there in the temple when they came, and the abomination of that was one of the things, and the leaders of the Roman right there in the temple.
Okay. So this seems to be something he says is going to be visible to them. And when it's visible to them, to Gary's point, they need to do something. So I don't see this as referencing the end as much as there is something specifically for these people to see and understand and do. And we'll get to that. Did I see a hand? Luke?
Well, and historically speaking, these things did happen. And it was pretty obvious that there was a sign. Like when the Romans took the temple, they actually killed Jews in the temple. But that phrase, abomination of desolation, shows up in Daniel. It also shows up in some of the intertestamental work. So it's not unusual that there be blood in the temple. It's a different thing when it winds up being the priest being killed in the temple, right? You've seen that. It's like, this is a sign. And a lot of those other things showed up too. Like he talks, if you read other historians, Tacitus and Josephus, he'll talk about how there were people who deluded others, like Theudas. And there was another guy, some Egyptian guy, who he said led away 30,000 people. So these things were totally happening back then. And Josephus mentions at one point there was a star that he says, his words, that was over the temple during the middle of the night, but it was so bright, it was like it was daytime. And people took this as a sign that something's going on. And you might think that's just kind of delusional, but it actually says, if you actually go back and read this, it says there's going to be signs in the heavens, so it does actually line up. And there's some other things in there. It's pretty eerie to read.
It is, and there's a lot of, Josephus is one that mentions it a few times, that they attribute there actually being signs, things happening in the sky. So let's catch up with Gary's point. Gary mentioned that it's in Daniel. We see in Daniel 11, Daniel's in the middle of talking about this king of the north is battling the king of the south, that being the Seleucids versus the Ptolemies, I believe. And the king of the north, which was Antiochus Epiphanes, came to the temple. His forces will rise up and desecrate the temple fortress. They will abolish the regular sacrifice and set up the abomination of desolation. And that's kind of timed in the intertestamental period. Daniel kind of points out some of the rulers there to give us that point of view for Daniel 11. And then it's also mentioned in Daniel 9. And this seems to be what Jesus is referencing when he says this. He will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and offering, and the abomination of desolation will be on a wing of the temple until the decreed destruction is poured out on the desolator. So there was going to be something that happened. It's interesting what Luke says. He doesn't use this phrase. Luke says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. So there would be something that would happen that would give these people point. And what does Jesus tell them to do? Run. Run. It's interesting. He mentions a specific region. He's like, if you find yourself in Judea, you're to run to the mountains. History tells us, it's really interesting, many of the Christians got out of Jerusalem. before the siege. They listened to Jesus. Whatever it was that was happening, they were watching, they were vigilant, and when it happened, they ran to the mountains. The siege lasted between 4 and 5 months. If you read history, it talks about in that section, basically, like, this is the worst it's ever been in the history of mankind. It did not describe a good time. People were eating people. Like, there was a struggle to survive happening in the city for the people that did not pay attention to the signs. Luke.
Yeah, I think you're probably referring to Eusebius, who says that they ran to a city called Pella. And it's weird because they actually had a window here. Like you said, Luke says that it's when you see it surrounded by armies, usually you don't have time to get out. But there was a change in the guard in the Roman leadership at the time when General Titus was brought in, and then the other guy was made the emperor. So there was a window where the army stopped, and it gave them this narrow window to get out. If you went out fast, you could do it. But also, this is incredibly countercultural, because what they would tell you to do is you go into the city. That's where there's all these storehouses of food. That's where you can wait out these armies. But if you read the history, they burned the food because they wanted the Jews wanted the other Jews to fight, and so it was the worst place to be. So Jesus is telling them this makes no sense, but he was totally right.
Have we seen that in Israel's history before? And that was Samaria. David?
Yeah, I think of Gideon when the Midianites were there, the innumerable host, and God kept saying, you got too many men. And that doesn't make any sense. But Gideon won. The Lord fought for them.
Yes.
When the Babylonians were taking over, and God told them through... was it Jeremiah? To not resist, do not flee, go to where I will take you, and you will plant gardens and build houses and get married.
Yeah, so he tells them through Jeremiah to basically, when the Babylonians come, surrender. Go out and surrender to him. And the people are like, we're in this walled city. Like, don't surrender to them. God's like, don't believe in the walls of Jerusalem. Don't believe in these nice buildings that the disciples are looking at. Like, these things won't ever be destroyed. He says, when you see something happening, go. And then it's interesting, I think, evidence pointing to this being the fall of Jerusalem. He's telling them, this is something you're going to be able to escape from. So do it. If we're talking about the end of the world, I don't know that running's going to do you much good. If we're talking about the fall of man and the final judgment... hide in the mountain, hide in the hill, run to the cave. Yeah. Yeah, hope it's not winter. Hope you're not pregnant or nursing. Yeah, I agree. I think there's contextual evidence for this being the fall of Jerusalem, and he's just trying to help them see this is when it's coming. This is what... again, what exactly that sign will be when it's the armies, whether it's a sign in heaven, watch for the sign and act.
This is something that I struggle with. Alan, you know this. Bob, you know this. I'm conflicted here. The Bible's telling me two things. One, if you see danger, run. Run out of the city. Another, stand. Stand firm and let me take care of everything. Have your faith in me. I see America today being destructed, very much in front of my eyes. I feel God telling me to run, but I feel my church telling me to stay, and I'm conflicted. I'm sorry.
If you follow God, there will be times where you are conflicted because you are trying to follow him in everything. You are trying to trust him. And at some point, you are going to have to make a decision based off of faith in God. And sometimes that decision is going to be, I'm going to leave. I'm going to run. I think a change is best. I think this is needed, and you're going to have to do that in faith. And there's going to be times where you say, I'm going to take a stand of faith, and I'm going to stay where I am. We're told righteousness is good for a nation. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Being a Christian doesn't mean we're all, I don't believe it means we're always going to have an easy solution or an easy answer to some of the difficult things. We see Paul willing to die for Christ, but we also see him in certain situations appealing to Caesar, appealing for guards to protect him on his route. I think it's going to be one where we have to prayerfully seek God's wisdom when we make decisions and do our best to see his will. And if he calls us to die for him, be willing to do that. And if he calls us to keep living for him, do that. But whatever that is, trust him in everything. Beth?
Again, to the heart and prayer, which you've just spoken about, but man's wisdom versus God's wisdom. And when we rely on ourselves and direct ourselves in that way versus our heart is with God and prayerfully we are praying for his guidance and we have his word. And I understand where you can be conflicted, but if that's solely your guide, then you'll be okay because your trust is where it needs to be. Always.
Yeah. Keep your trust. Keep your eyes on Jesus. Luke, and then we'll get back to Gary.
Yeah, I think the thing, the answer to Dale's question is that Jesus is referring to a very particular situation here.
Yes.
And so none of us could actually do most of this command because we're all born, unless you're 2,000 years old or older, you couldn't actually have done this, right? Because he's referring to this very particular event, which is why it's specific. Like the whole point about nursing infants in winter, obviously he's not talking about the end of the entire world because, I mean, who cares if you have nursing infants in winter, right? It's like there's nothing you can do. Now, Gary had mentioned this earlier, which is that I just prefer the Matthew account because of the structure of it is easier to follow because when you get to those three questions, and the third question, Jesus draws a hard distinction there. He's saying that third one, the end of all ages, he says, but of that day, he starts off. Then he draws a distinction, says that's different. He says, listen, I don't know, okay? Only the Father knows, and I'm not giving you answers for signs on that. That's going to be a mystery. That day you're going to treat differently. That's the one where we have to be ready for.
Yeah, so for those tracking in Mark, what Luke is pointing out is verse 32. He mentions, well, regarding that day or hour, no one knows. So he's just told them, here is a sign, here is going to be evidence of one event happening, but there's going to be another event happening that's not going to have a sign, that's not going to have this representation so you know when it's coming. Context is the same. Be prepared. Keep your eyes on God. The ones that have faith will endure to the end. Gary and then Nina.
After being through this study a few times, somebody mentioned, made a comment that just really stuck with me, just pointing out the long-suffering of God, how after Jesus came and established the New Testament, the New Covenant, God gave them roughly 40 years to come along and for their eyes to be opened and for them to understand and follow him. And then after that time was up, the temple was destroyed. Not only was the temple destroyed, but all of the records that the Jews relied on, like with the Levitical priesthood, you had to be able to prove that you were of the right lineage to be able to serve. All of that stuff was destroyed. So it wasn't just a temple. It was a complete destruction of the whole system. And that was purposefully done from God to take that away, and with the city being surrounded and all the people being destroyed, that was his way of punishing the people for refusing and punishing his son. It was a closure, if you will.
Yeah, and that was something he had talked about since Deuteronomy, the blessings and cursings. If you obey me, you will live in this land. If you do not, you will be taken out of this land.
I was going to say, God always used evil people, or often used evil people, to bring about his plan because it was in the plan. And you can see that here, that he's using the Romans to bring about his plan, because he said the temple and all that will be destroyed. That whole law will be destroyed, but he didn't, it'll be destroyed through the evil hands of man. But you also see him in this, because he's saying, run for the hills. So if you listen to him, you won't be part of this destruction, but you can see him for a fact in when he says in 20, and if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. So you see his hand in this for his people. He is guarding and guiding his people, even though the evil is going to destroy all of it. And anybody that will listen to him will not be destroyed.
And you see similar conversations in Habakkuk when Habakkuk's looking at Israel and he's like, do you not see how bad this is? And God's like, yes, I'm going to send the Chaldeans. They're going to be fierce. And Habakkuk's like, the Chaldeans? Like, that's worse than the people we currently have. And God says, I know, I'll take care of the Chaldeans too. God has a history of using nations as he sees fit. We see this is, I mean, this is a just a very vivid picture of God just working nations for his glory. He is always in control of this, and he's not forgotten his people in all of this. Alan, and then
the bookends here are, they're talking about those buildings and things like that in Jerusalem. And then in verse 30, he says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So in this particular passage, he's talking about that generation. Other places he talks about in Thessalonians and other places about the end of our time. But in this particular context, you have to say everything in between the bookends has to make sense in that context. And even the spiritual language there that's talked about that you'll get to, it's all has to be in that context.
Yeah, I agree with you, Alan. And
God told the Israelites at the Red Sea to just stand. Just trust me. I'm going to do the work. You're not going to do anything. He told Joshua to go into the land and fight. Trust me. I'm going to be with you, but I want you to fight. He told Lot and his family to run for the hills. Trust me. This is what you need to do in this situation. All of these instructions were about trust. All of them seemed counterintuitive, which is what God is. He is counterintuitive because he's not us. And so what we think makes sense isn't right. What he thinks makes sense is right. And so all of these, whether he's telling you to go or stay, run, fight, it's all about trust. In every one of these, he's making the same point in a different way. Trust me, I'm taking care of you.
Very well said. Tony?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, though, like in verses 9 and following, of the things that they will have to endure because of this corrupt Jewish system. That wasn't what God wanted, but the persecution, the severe persecution they're going to receive from their own brethren, and that this is God's answer to that. It's like in Revelation when you have the dead saints that are from the altar are crying out, how long, O Lord? And he's saying, well, not yet. The fullness of the blood has not been taken up, but that he gives answer to this, that there will be a reprieve of their persecution because he's going to bring an end to them. And so it sounds terrible, except if you're the ones being persecuted, this actually is a very hopeful message of that there will be an end, and it'll be in our lifetime. There will be an end to this.
And it's part of our struggle with this concept of judgment, right? God comes in judgment. If you're opposing God, what does that look like? It looks horrible. If you're on God's side, what does that look like? Sometimes it's hope, and sometimes it's buckle up. Hope is there, but it's going to be hard. You're caught in the middle of it. You are on God's side. God hadn't forgotten his people. Some writers, as they point to this, say that their view of this is the Christians were hiding in caves, and that if the siege had lasted much longer, they believe that the Romans could have found them. And so that's what they point to here, basically saying because God knew where his people were, he allowed the siege to last only a certain amount of time. He was enacting judgment, but keeping an eye on his people. I don't know what to make of that, but ultimately as Christians, we believe that God can do things like that. As he's enacting judgment, he knows who are his, and he watches out for those. We'll continue in chapter 13 on Wednesday. One thing to note, I'll try to send out some questions, but as we begin in verses 34 through 36, specifically look at some of those phrases and see if you can find them in the Old Testament. Because as Alan put, I think that does give us insight into what Jesus is talking about, because it sounds very apocalyptic and very earth-ending. But as we look through the Old Testament, we find some other uses of where God used that and what it described. So pay close attention to that. Thank you for your thoughts and comments.